But one of the questions that is going to arise among the people of God who are thinking about what's happening in the world and what's going on is, how are we as Christians expected to react in an unjust world? Now, I know that many of you in this congregation understand the world around you. I think you're pretty aware of what's happening in the world. I think you understand some of the prophetic implications of the world that we live in, and you certainly, as a very mature congregation, seasoned congregation, notice I didn't say you're old, but you're experienced and you've been around for a long time, and you understand a lot. You understand what's happening in the world, and a lot, like a lot of us, you're probably wondering what's going to come next, and how do we and how should we prepare as Christians? And as we see the winds of change in our nation and other Western nations, how do we live in a world that is becoming increasingly more evil and more unjust? Let's ask the question, do we live in an unjust world governed by unjust men? My title today is Living in an Unjust World. I don't know that I can do justice in one sermon, but I'll try to give you a little snippet of things that I think are helpful. But do we live in an unjust world that is governed by unjust men? Is this world becoming worse and worse, as I have alleged, citing the prophecy of Timothy that evil men are going to wax worse and worse, or is it always been that way? Has it been this way for many years and we're just kind of tumbling onto it, or have we been shielded from a lot of that? I'd like to recount a story. Funny that Steve spoke earlier and mentioned his experience and our experience, which was shared in Ambassador College, but I've shared some of this story before, but I think it's pertinent to share it at this time as well. In 1972, he and I arrived at the campus of Ambassador College in Brickett Wood. And the next week after we got there, as was his custom since he started the college in 1948, Mr. Herbert Armstrong arrived and had what was called freshman orientation with us. In those years, maybe not so much towards his latter years of the college and, you know, having the demands of three colleges and his age, just getting very elderly, not so much. But in those years, he liked to meet with the freshman class, and obviously he couldn't meet with every single person. I mean, we had 60 people in our class or thereabouts, and there were larger classes in Big Sandy and then also in Pasadena, California. But he didn't have the opportunity really. He wasn't the kind of person that, you know, was a mingler and got in with a lot of people, especially later on in life. But he did meet with us as a group. And I remember that it was near the what we called the library building, which was a massive former mansion, all marble and stone and beautiful granite, and just incredible. And we were meeting outside in one of the beautiful landscaped lawns. And it was in the afternoon, and we were all dressed up to meet Mr. Armstrong, and he gave us a very inspirational talk about how all of this, as he's motioning around to the beautiful grounds, all this came to be and how it all transpired through the years, gave us a little history of the work of God from the time that he was called in 1927 and left a career in advertising and business and that sort of thing, and began studying the Bible and studying the Sabbath and proving the Sabbath and then eventually proving the holy days. And he gave us kind of a thumbnail sketch of his life, the history of the church, history of what had happened from that time in 1927. And I haven't really shared even a lot of these stories with my kids because they're just, you know, kind of when you're raising your own children, you're not really thinking of explaining all these kinds of things. But I think there are probably some pretty good lessons in some of these stories. And although I've shared some of this story with you, maybe not all of it, but I think they're probably helpful in sharing some of the history with those that didn't have the opportunity or those that may not have even been alive during that particular time. So Mr. Armstrong gave us kind of a snippet of life, and it was, I have to say, looking back, it was pretty awe-inspiring to know that here was somebody that was the founder, so to speak, of the modern era of our church, and we could trace the historical antecedents back even further than that and have done so, but it was inspiring, even though we're all kind of young and wet behind the ears. It was kind of interesting to hear what the firsthand experience that Mr. Armstrong gave to us. So the atmosphere of this incredible place in which we were listening to him was, oven by itself, it was just kind of magical. We're on an estate that had been owned by the richest man in India. He was a Scottish businessman. His name was Sir David Yule. He was knighted by, who was the king? I've got it here. He was knighted by the king in 1912, King George, and knighted this individual. And I wouldn't be born for another 40 years after the knighting of Sir David Yule. And here we were 60 years later after him being knighted, and we are on the grounds that he once owned, this beautiful palatial estate. Now here's the shocking thing for me just to think about. I hadn't really thought about it too much, but I was 20 years old at the time. Mr. Armstrong was 80 in that year. Incredible, and still going strong. So we had the opportunity to kind of, after he gave his little address to us, we had the opportunity to kind of mingle and kind of, you know, get a little closer in for maybe a personal conversation. And I summoned up the courage to ask this question. I was scared to death, but I had only been attending services for a little less than a year at that time and had been baptized since January of that year. But I had heard enough about his work and what he was doing at that point in his career as kind of an ambassador without portfolio, without a country to represent, so to speak, as he used to say. And I summed up the courage and I said, Mr. Armstrong, how do you arrange the meetings with world leaders? And his response was immediate and dramatic, and he was almost offended at the question. He said, I don't! Those of you that had the opportunity to hear Mr. Armstrong speak personally, you know that he could be quite dramatic. And I was kind of taken aback, but he was struck by the question and felt it was so important, he kind of stopped all the other conversations and went into a little introduction about the fact that he doesn't seek these meetings with world leaders. And at that time, and I'm giving this story for the benefit of those of you who weren't around, maybe forgotten, or maybe you weren't even born at that particular time, but there was a substantial number of people that sought out meetings with Herbert Armstrong, this guy that was, you know, the leader of a relatively small church based in Southern California. But here, let me recount some of those, not all of them, but some of the leaders Herbert Armstrong met with and what he told them. And I think even those of you that have been around for a long time and remember some of this are going to be surprised in terms of just remembering the vast numbers of people that he contacted or that had contact with him. Well, this one everybody will know, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher of Great Britain, King Leopold of the Royal Family of Belgium. He met Nancy Reagan while she was the First Lady. He met the Chinese Premier Deng Xiaoping. Of course, many of you will remember this, the Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, Golda Meir of Israel, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi of India, King Hussein of Jordan, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat before he was assassinated, and Hosni Mubarak. You'll remember some of these. He met the Emperor, the Crown Prince, and seven successive prime ministers of Japan from 1970 onward, which is amazing. And then there were numerous members of the Japanese Congress called the Japanese Diet who called Mr. Armstrong his Japanese sons, their father actually, but they called themselves his Japanese sons. And also, as I've relayed to you, that Ellis LaRavia several years ago imparted to me that Mr. Armstrong met with now King Charles, Prince Charles at the time. And while he and Gwen were meeting with Princess Diana for about 4 hours one afternoon, Mr. Armstrong was preaching the gospel to Prince Charles, who's now king, unfortunately has some health problems from what I've heard. Now, that's a short list of individuals that Herbert Armstrong came in contact with, and what did he tell them? Well, he didn't open up the Bible in most cases, but he used the first few chapters of the book of Genesis and rephrased it and talked about two ways of life, the way of give, the way of get, the way of selfishness, greed, and animosity and competition, and conversely, the way of openness and giving and helping one another. So why is all of that important? Well, here's why. Several generations ago, some, maybe not all the leaders who met with Herbert Armstrong were the leadership of the world at that time, these individuals that I've mentioned to you. I think that most of us would agree that despite the differences of the nations, if you look into the history of most of them, they were pretty honorable individuals, honorable men, leading their nations, leading their people. Maybe not all. In some cases, some of them, we found out, weren't so honorable. There was President Ferdinand Marcos, who was kind of a thug in his nation. I think history kind of records him as a tyrant. Most of the rest weren't perfect by any means, but that's on them. Mr. Armstrong felt that his commission was to speak to those individuals and to preach the gospel to them and to tell them that there was going to be a better world that would be coming in the future. One of the questions I believe that we need to address in our church, and maybe all the churches of God, is how do we respond to the leaders who rule over us in this world today? What is a Christian's responsibility? Now, I gave some of this background, and speaking about some of these things that are personal experiences, for the benefit of those who may not have been alive and those that may not have been aware, may not have been a part of the church. And also, I realize I'm kind of an expert in generations, okay? All right, I'm kind of my thing. I had to work with various generations. The generations. I found about a new one. There's the lost generation. I'd never heard of that until I was researching for this sermon. The lost generation are the people that were born in the early part of the 20th century and up until, around the time of the Great Depression. Of course, that, I don't know why they're called lost, but that's what they call them. They call them the lost generation, I suppose, because of the effects of World War I, which was incredible for some of the nations during those years, and loss of life was tremendous. And then there was the Great Depression. I guess, technically speaking, I've always thought of my father living in the greatest generation because he was, a World War II hero. He really was. Had the battle commendations to prove it, although, he didn't talk about that. But, like some of our other, members' fathers who fought in World War II, they were heroes too. They did what they could for their country at that particular time. But I always placed my dad in the greatest generation, and we know what the greatest generation did and the sacrifices they made. But the lost generation sacrificed a lot as well. Went through some difficult times in the early part of the first century. And then there are, of course, the most notable generation, probably the brightest and the smartest, the most able, the boomer generation, of which many of us are a part of, the most adept, the most pliable, the most generous, giving, smart, et cetera, et cetera. Then after that, we've got the Gen X, kind of a latchkey generation, independent, kind of selfish, self-absorbed, lazy. We've got the millennials, who are even lazier than that and kind of stuck in their tech, think that they're experts, and they make fun of the boomers. Then we've got Generation Z, who's, again, totally lost. Now, that's the lost generation. I'm just kidding. That's all a joke. We deal with the situation that we're born into, right? And all of us come from different backgrounds if we're different generations. But the thing that remains constant is our need to be able to adapt in a Christian way to the world that is presented to us at this time, no matter what generation. Obviously, I'm saying what I said for humor's sake. I mean, you're all great, all of you, Gen Z, X, Y, millennial. Pretty good. Pretty good. Boomers are the best. Okay. Most of the leaders at least gave Herbert Armstrong the time of day. Now, people could argue, well, what good did it really do? What did it do? Well, you know, that's for God to judge later on, I think. Maybe there'll be some great effect that those things happen. I mean, in those years, we're all caught up, and even as students, we were caught up in terms of the gospel message and wanting to be a part of that. And here we were, 20 years old, some a little bit older, younger, some a little bit older than that, and we're meeting a man who we held in very high esteem and wondering about his work, and he was adamant that he didn't set the meetings, he didn't seek the meetings, the people came to him, and that was true. And I think one of the things that we need to address is, because of some of the biblical injunction, is how do we respond as we see the world becoming more and more evil and more destructive, and the kind of deception that is there in our world today. As somebody that has studied a lot of these things, and many of you, I'm not the only one, many of you have done this as well, it is a far different world than that time in 1972, even though, you know, a lot of us may have thought, well, you know, we've got to get the work done, this time is short, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That wasn't necessarily true. It's 50 years later, and it's hasn't been accomplished yet. So we still have to plod on. But how do we navigate through this world, which becomes more and more evil? And I think there's probably been a little bit of misinformation regarding some of the scriptures that we find that tell a Christian how to react in the world. And I've covered some of these before, and I'm going to cover them today as well, add a little bit more commentary. I'd like to ask you to first turn to Romans chapter 13 and verse 1. I think there's some misconceptions on some of the things. I'll try to comment on them. And in Romans 13 and verse 1, we read, this is so good. Again, as I say, give me just a moment. I can read that now for the first time in weeks. Like I mentioned, I can actually read that screen, which is a little smaller than that screen, but anyway, kind of nice. Okay. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And so people used to tell me, that means God has appointed all leaders in the world, and we need to listen to them. Well, specifically, this does not say that God appoints all leaders. What it does mean is that God allows men to rule, and he's done that ever since the flood, right? He's allowed men to rule. Mr. Armstrong used to say he's had a hands-off approach to the world from that time, except when he intervenes and calls somebody to salvation. But what it does say is that there are authorities that God allows. Authorities are the same as offices, and God allows this at this time for man's rules. So if you're following along in your Bible, then hold your place there in Romans 13. And I'd like to go to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 32, which gives a very, very, very brief history of what happened after the flood and the genealogies and that sort of thing. In Genesis 10 and verse 32, we read, "These were the families of the sons of Noah, according to their generations in their nations." There were, according to tradition, 70 nations that existed after the flood. And actually, one of the traditions of the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles is that the Jews would celebrate they would celebrate during the water ceremony on that seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's when Christ got up to speak. But they would celebrate with willows, which would be representative of the 70 nations, because they knew that they would also be a part of God's plan. There's a lot more to that, and I've given detailed messages on that before, but that was a part of the ceremony, the water ceremony, and the the threshing of the willows that would take place during that very important ceremony. But they traditionally understood that there were 70 nations, and they would actually offer during the entire feast, beginning with the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, they would begin with sacrifices that would eventually end up in the number 70 at the end. I mean, it would be a descending order, so more on that in another time. But the nations of the world developed, and we know that they developed apart from God, but as they were scattered on the earth, because God had to intervene, which would, you know, be the purpose of which would be to prevent the anarchy that had existed in the pre-diluvial world, where everybody was going, you know, murdering, and, you know, everybody was going crazy, and man was probably going to destroy himself if God hadn't done so. But in the previous chapter, in chapter 9, in verse 5, God established guidelines. These are very briefly mentioned, and the death penalty was in place. And whether man's governments imposed it or not, there was this requirement, as you read in Genesis 9 and verse 5. Surely, for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. So the death penalty was allowed by God at that time in history. And again, whether or not it was imposed by man's governments and whether they agree with that doesn't obviate the fact that it was imposed and allowed. Now, God says there's a reckoning for taking the life of another man. Now, that reckoning may not be imposed in this day and age. That reckoning, that coming to justice, may not always be imposed during the lifetime of man. It may not be until the time of the great resurrection. This is my belief, that at that time, think about it, have you ever thought about the ramifications of the very beginning of what we call the Great White Throne Judgment, Revelation 20 and verse 12, when everybody who's ever lived is going to be resurrected and brought back to life and have an opportunity for salvation? Have you ever thought about how sobering those first few moments or years may be as people come to grips with what they have done in their lives, no matter what era they have lived in? So that reckoning may not be imposed until that particular time, but in addition to that, the same judgment for hating your brother is also going to be understood and taught, that that's a sin as well, as Christ said, that hate is like murder, right? So the initial stages of what is called, it's not in the Bible the phrase, but the Great White Throne Judgment, may be really sobering for a lot of people who have lived and now they're faced with the sins of their previous life and the consequence of death, because Paul said in Romans 3:23 that sin is a transgression of the law, and in Romans 6:23 the penalty for sin is death, right? So, and then in addition to that, they will all be given the opportunity to repent, as Paul mentions. You can jot this down in Acts 17 and verse 30. In fact, in Paul's discourse in Athens in Acts 17, he elaborates on the purpose for the nations that are outlined in Genesis 10. And he talks about it in chapter 17, verses 26 and 27, although I hadn't intended to turn to that. I'm going to turn to that. If you guys can pull it up, then that's great. I threw you a little curve. I put it in the notes, but I didn't write it out. But in Acts 17 and verse 26, we read, "And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell in the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings." The 70 nations that I mentioned, the people that were scattered after the time of the flood, God set them in place and set those nations in place, so that they should seek the Lord eventually in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each of us. And that will eventually happen for all of mankind. They'll have that opportunity. Now, getting back to Romans 13, I think some have misused Romans 13, maybe a few other scriptures, to indicate that Christian resistance to governments is wrong or futile, and that Christians must submit to that power because it comes from God. And I think if you're unlearned in terms of the scriptures, maybe you could read that into that particular verse. But is that true? Let's continue on with Paul's instruction. In verse 2, therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. Now, we don't want to do that, do we? You don't want to resist God. And so you're thinking about man's governments, and maybe we need to be subject to those governments. We don't want to resist God. And it says, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Okay, if you were to just stop right there and not take the entire context of the verse, then maybe you could come away with that idea. But you've got to read further. Obviously, we don't want to resist the will of God. But let's also notice the qualification on the power and the authority that is placed on worldly leaders and the offices that are allowed to men. Verse 3 helps qualify this. For the rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. So the implied caveat here is that the rulers of this world exist for the purpose of actually protecting people who will be obedient to law. And they're not a terror if you're going to live in society in a peaceful condition, which we all should do. We all should be law abiders. We should all, you know, this is what is said later on in the general epistles, that we, you know, if we suffer for wrongdoing, that's, you know, that can happen to a Christian. But don't let it happen because you don't suffer yourself because you made a stupid mistake and done something that is illegal in the society in which you live. From the dawn of the nations, for a nation to continue and to be any kind of coherent type of society, there has to be law, there has to be order, it has to be based on some moral code and authority. And many of the nations of the world at least have had some semblance. I mean, they had some semblance of law and order in even the Roman Empire, the ancient Roman Empire, or in Babylon or in Egypt. But Paul's instruction is that, and the caveat is that we have to remember that they are empowered to go only so far, and their authority extends to the point to where they are protecting those who are going to be obedient themselves. Continuing on, do you want to be afraid of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you. No, he's not called by God. God didn't put him there. He allowed the office. He allows men to inhabit that as office. He didn't pick some guy, say, you know, I'm going to put this guy in as the constable over here, or this guy would make a good king. Hands off. That's what Mr. Armstrong always taught us from the Garden of Eden. But he allowed the nations to exist. He allowed the offices to exist. And he allows people to rule in the kingdoms of men. But it says, for he is God's minister to you for good. For good. He's supposed to do the right thing. So this specifies the limit of the power of human leaders. And notice that the leaders of this world are only servants of God's purpose when they enforce what God created, which is law. He's not God's minister to you for bad. Or in the case of some of the leaders of the past, the present, and the future, we are not to be subject to evil people when they ask us to do bad things or evil things. Going on, Paul says, but if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. That's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to punish the people that might harm us or the rest of society. But if he practices evil as a human leader, is he absolved from his responsibility? Absolutely not. He can't be. I mean, God doesn't like it when people take absolute power and use it for evil means. And that's why Paul said to Timothy, evil men will wax worse and worse, or they get worse and worse. And that's the society that, you know, however long we live on this earth, we are faced with living in a more evil, progressively evil world. And how do we operate within that? Verse 5, therefore you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. I mean, even from the standpoint of you don't get caught, let's say. And I'm not talking about a parking ticket or occasional random speeding, which I don't know if anybody that does that here or anything like that, but I'm not talking about those things. I'm talking about major problems. Even if you're not caught, you should be led by your conscience, by the Spirit of God, to realize you might be doing the wrong thing. And as a member of society, you are required by God to obey your Spirit-led and educated conscience. Now, here's another passage I think some have sometimes ignorantly used a little bit. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. There's actually three passages in the New Testament. Paul's got two, Peter's got one. This is one that Peter uses. I mean, he agrees completely with Paul's instruction, but they're very similar. I think, you know, it's a good idea to mark them, you know, if you're a Bible marker. Got a good tip from Larry Walker the other day. He's one of our great ministers of great experience, a real great Bible student. But he said, you know, mark your Bible. You know, you can use colored pencils and that sort of thing if you like. But if you're going to write something in it, do it with a number two pencil, or do it with a pencil so it doesn't bleed through on the page. Because, you know, look at my first Bible, the Oxford Bible that I got. You know, the ink we used at that time, you know, the Bic ink has bled through in a lot of the pages. But anyway, just a tip. 1 Peter 2 and verse 13, therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme. So on the surface, once again, if you just stop right here, it almost sounds that Peter, like Paul, is advocating submission to governmental authority without question. But the key phrase here is for the Lord's sake. And unfortunately, a number of English translations are not very good at this. They make it seem as though submission at all costs is a noble and Christian thing to do. Just submit, even if it's going to hurt you, blah, blah. Well, not quite. Here's one that's correct. The Jubilee 2000 Bible. It says, therefore, be subject to every human ordinance, wait for it, that is of the Lord. So rather than saying you should be completely submissive to everything the government says, Peter said, be submissive to those things that are in agreement with God's laws. And then he adds, whether it be a king or to a superior. So in work, in government, as a citizen, if there's a human ordinance that agrees with God and his law, then yes, obey it. It's basically one and the same. But obviously, if you're told by the government to do something you know is ungodly, are you going to do it? No, you're not going to do it. When ruling authorities obey and enforce the law of God, we should obey them. That's what this scripture is saying. It's further qualified in the next verse, verse 14, or to governors, as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers. That's why the authorities exist. Now, in a world that's becoming increasingly more dangerous and evil, what do we find? We find that oftentimes the evildoers are not punished, but maybe sometimes the righteous in this world are. That is what Paul was implying when he said that evil men are going to get worse and worse because many of them become leaders. And as it says, I'm not going to go there, you don't have to put it up, guys, but as it says in Ephesians 2 and verse 2, the individuals that are not subject to God at all are going to be targeted with that frequency of the prince of the power of the air in a greater way, as I've said before, than your next door neighbor who goes to church on Sunday and believes in God. No, yes, yes, yes. Maybe. Maybe they're not keeping the Sabbath or the holy days. Maybe they're not totally obedient, but they're more obedient than this guy that is telling you that it's okay to do such and such, which we know is against the law of God. I hope that is clear. So going on, for the punishment of evildoers, that's why they exist, and for the praise of those who do good. Now, the honorable men that Herbert Armstrong was sent to and spoke to about their societies and their nations, they were in place to protect their populations, and God allowed them to be in that place. He didn't place them there, but Mr. Armstrong talked to them about the way of give and the way of get in terms of even governing their nations. This is the will of God, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. A little bit more on that doing good in just a second. But let's go to the last scripture here on this particular theme of what God expects of Christians in a society, whether it was 50 years ago, or whether it's one in which we live today, which we see the results of it becoming more and more stressful, difficult, and evil. Because the purpose for God allowing human government's control on the earth after the time of the flood was to provide some stability, at least, until the time of Jesus Christ's return. Now, Bible prophecy shows us that, you know, there will be a cascade of events that will change life dramatically for all of us. But before that, in Titus chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul telling, you know, Titus as a minister, like he gave advice to Timothy, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. This is the way we as Christians are to act. Peaceable, honorable, gentle, humble. And once again, the qualification of God's inspired word is that a Christian should be obedient and respectful for good works, which are the result of godly obedience. Now, if you do a study, which I'd encourage you to do a study of the term good works in the New Testament, you'll find that phrase 20 times or thereabouts, about 20 times, like Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10. Good works, what does it mean? It helps us to understand the qualification that Paul gave to Timothy or Titus here. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10 says, "For we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works." That's our job. We're supposed to have good works. And what are good works? Obedience to the law, basically, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. We should walk in good works. We should be obedient members of society. We should do what the leaders of society tell us as long as they agree with God. But if they force us into a corner and try to get us to obey things that are unlawful, then obviously, you know, there's no question as to what we should do. So if human leaders and governments respect our ability to worship God, allowing good works and obedience to God, then we can submit to their leadership. Now, it's interesting to note that when Peter and Paul wrote these admonitions to the church of God, it was during the time period beginning with Romans, which we think was written around 57 AD, and then the letter to Titus about 62 AD, and then a letter to 1 Peter about 64 AD, and why is that important? Do you know who the Roman emperor was at that time that they were under the authority of? It was a young lad by the name of Nero, came to the throne at the age of 16, committed suicide 14 years later when he was 30. But most of history records him as basically a tyrant. Now, some of the stories may be fanciful or made up about his rule, but in each case, when these letters went out to the members of the church, the most powerful leader in the world was admittedly a tyrant. He died at 68 AD, but no matter the Roman emperor, history records them basically as tyrants who had absolute authority, the power of life and death in their hands. And this makes the instruction of the Bible from Peter and Paul even more remarkable, especially during the times that the dictatorial control of individual behavior was pretty widespread throughout the Roman Empire. Although they did give some leeway to local government and that sort of thing, the power and the control over individual lives was sometimes suffocating, as we read in the events of the first century AD, the life of Christ, John the Baptist, and others. But specifically, these three verses don't teach Christians to get along with just anything. Far from it. What would Peter and Paul have thought about life in the United States that has championed individual rights and freedoms since the time of the Revolutionary War? You know, if they had seen what has developed, would their minds be blown about the freedoms that exist as opposed to the tyranny of a Roman emperor? Almost 250 years ago, the freedom of the press, individual freedom rights, freedom of speech, even defiance towards an unjust authority became the hallmark in the origins of the founding of our nation. And from that time, the biblical theme of freedom has resonated to other parts of the world and been accepted in other parts of the world. It's just been an amazing thing, just the example. Now, we've exported a lot of other bad things throughout the world as well as the United States. But interestingly, it has been a rising tide of freedom that has lifted a lot of other peoples in the last 200 years. Understanding the difference in the first century and today, when there was autocratic rule and the divine right of kings, which meant might makes right. You know, we tell you what to do and you listen to us or we kill you. Not a nice type of society to live in. Shortly after Pentecost in 31 AD, the church was growing and the message of a new kingdom of God was resonating and gaining converts. But in Acts 5, under some pretty severe restrictions, both by the government of Rome and then because that government allowed the religious authorities to rule as well. Acts 5, remember the Star Wars movie? You know, the second one. You remember the second one? The Empire Strikes Back. You know, the Empire struck back at the rebels. It's a good analogy to use because after the church began to grow by leaps and bounds, guess what happened? The Empire struck back or began to strike back. Scores and hundreds of people were healed of all manner of dreadful diseases leading up to this particular story, and the result was that from all of this, as you'll read in Acts 5, read the chapter later, they were all thrown in prison. And this is where it almost becomes kind of comical. As you're reading through the narrative in Acts chapter 5 and verse 19, the apostles are in prison. They're in prison for healing people of dreadful diseases and preaching the gospel of a coming kingdom that's going to replace that one and all others. It says, but at night an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors and brought them out and said, go stand in the temple and speak to the people all the words of this life. In other words, get back. Get back to the temple. Do what you were doing. So what do they do? When an angel tells you to do something, you do it, right? You don't hesitate, you just do it. And when they heard that, they entered the temple early in the morning and taught. Then the religious leaders wanted to know what happened to the men that they imprisoned because they couldn't find them there. And you read through the narrative, Acts chapter 5 and verse 25, it says, so one came and told them, look, the men whom you're put in prison, they're in the temple teaching the people. They couldn't find them. They weren't going to look, and I mean, that'd be the last place they'd look, right? Because they forbade them to do this. But it's almost kind of funny when you read through it. You know, somebody goes and says, hey, those guys, they're over there. Maybe just me. Acts 5 and verse 28, they said to them, did we not strictly command you not to teach in his name? And look, you've fill Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us. How dare you? Yes, we did kill him, but you're intending to bring his blood on us now. Well, you killed him. Yes, that's right, but you're intending to make us feel guilty for it. okay, yeah, that's the point, because you did it. But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. Sometimes you just have to let the chips fall where they may, and you have to be wise about this, because there are some things that we found out in the past 4 years that we may be made to do. You know, they don't break God's law, but they make us pretty angry. We don't want to do them. And if we can get away with not doing them, we do it. And we have. And we will. I mean, I hope we don't have to. I'm just anticipating we're going to have to face some of these things in the future. But as I wrap up today, and this is not going to be a short wrap up, so don't get too excited about me closing early. Yes! Hey, I've been there. Here are some problems that confront you. And I'm speaking to you out there in webcast land and those that might hear this later. I may not be so popular or funny after I'm finished with this, but I hope you'll get the point, and I hope you'll get the gist. Some of the problems that confront those of us who have benefited greatly are that we have been the recipients of the greatest blessings that have been bestowed on a people in the history of mankind. And not that you shouldn't feel guilty about that. You know, you shouldn't feel guilty about being American or living in Australia or New Zealand and reaping the blessings of Abraham and being wealthy by the rest of the world's standards. Don't ever feel guilty. God gave it to you. He allowed you to have it. Feel thankful, if anything else. But people would still try to make you feel guilty for that. But within that, one of the potential problems we all have is that we have been so blinded by these overwhelming blessings, and the poorest person among us has the potential to be blinded to what's going on in the reality of the world because of these great blessings. And I asked the question earlier, are we just seeing evil in leaders now, or is it just being exposed now? I kind of think it's probably been a little bit of both. Going back to my lifetime, you know, I can think of some honorable people that occupied offices, you know, when I was a little kid. And then information has come to light through the years that show maybe this guy wasn't such a good president after all. Maybe not so good. Maybe did some bad things. Maybe some horrible things. Won't get into that. But do we really understand how blessed this nation has been, and that for many of us, we have been shielded from the consequences of the works of evil? Because somehow or another, we've lived in a world and a society where it kind of seems to right itself. You know, I think there has been a progression of achievement of evil doing through the years. But my point is, most of us haven't faced the consequences of the decisions of evil people that will eventually overtake the English-speaking peoples of the world, and then obviously the rest of the world as well. I speak of illegal immigration. I've spoken on that topic before, but they project current rates, another 4 million people will enter the nation illegally. We can't cope with that kind, even if all of those folks were hardworking and great people and just wanted to work for minimum wage and take care of their families and do that. We don't have the resources to do that. Upwards of 25 million have come into the nation for the past 3 years. We just cannot continue to absorb that without it having an effect. So you see, we've been so blessed as a nation that we've been able to absorb the impact, and not that people haven't suffered at the hands of some of these things. Yes, there have been consequences. It's just that most of us haven't personally been aware of it. But we will. We see the compromise of our financial institutions. And again, we've had to deal with inflation, but most of us still doing okay. We've having increasing national indebtedness, printing of money. We printed more money in the last 3 years than has ever been in the creation of the United States for its entire history. That will have an effect. We've got endless wars that we have been a part of for many years. And again, we take care of other nations before we take care of our own. Where's the justice for the people in Maui? Where's the justice for the people in East Palestine, Ohio? Where's the justice for some of the veterans, the homeless? And yet we give preference to those entering our nation illegally. So we have a two-tiered justice system, an injustice, depending on who you are and what your political views are. My point is this. These things are going to begin to affect us all, and we need to pray for the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ on this earth. And most of our lives, we have enjoyed such prosperity that we could be in danger of being unaware of what is actually and rapidly happening throughout the world. You know, throughout the many years, the church has preached, watch. Watch what's happening in the world, even if it doesn't affect you personally. But sometimes if it's not a personal affect, and I don't want it to personally affect you or me, you know, that's my concern for each and every person that is watching this, that is here today. I don't want anybody to be negatively impacted. Nobody, not church members or anything else, but we see these things that are evil events that are happening, and the Bible speaks of other horrific events of the end time or the time of the end. But here we come down to it. Sometimes this is the way it is. Let's just say for the people outside the walls. If it doesn't affect you personally, if you don't have the implications and the consequences that affect you personally, it's like, meh. Maybe it's not really happening. Maybe it's not all that bad. And you cannot prepare your way out of this. Okay, you know, I've said this. I think others have said it. I published an article in my website by David Elliott. Stock up. Get some extra food. Do this, do that. But you're not going to prepare yourself out of the Great Tribulation. You're not going to prepare yourself out of Jacob's troubles. It's just not going to happen. You know, wars, rumors of wars, maybe you haven't lost anybody to those. False Christs, yeah, sure, they've always been around, people will say. But in addition to this blinding, in my opinion, we also have had, unfortunately, within the Church of God, ever since I came into it, an attitude of what I call, well, it's not my verse, my choice, but it's called moral equivalency. And that is that when you look at, okay, this is one side of the political spectrum, this is the other side, they're diametrically opposed to one another, right? The moral equivalency argument is that, I really like this group over here, you guys are good. I mean, I really like you, right here, good. You guys, maybe not so much. Get the point. The moral equivalency argument says that because all of you are imperfect, you're all bad. Well, we can't view the world that way. But sometimes within the Church of God, we have tended to do that. And in a greater sense, yes, it's true. But then if you take that moral equivalency argument and say that everything is bad because it's not perfect, you're going to miss out on the person or the individual or the institution that actually is trying to do something good. And you won't be able to see it. But you say, you know, I'm a church member. Unless it's the kingdom of God, it's all bad. I do see this in the Church of God today. Now, I'm not saying I'm the expert, and I'm not saying it's a real huge flaw, but I think it's kind of been something that has been bred into us. Maybe it's not all that black and white, but if we accept this premise that because everything is not godly, then it's all equally bad, well, it's not. Okay, for instance, you want an example? Okay, if there is a president who the first time in the history of all of our American presidents goes to a demonstration in Washington, D.C. for the right to life, and he says, I'm with you, and I'm behind you, and I support you, and I support the right to life, that's good. It's not evil. You got to tip your hat at least to that guy that says that. Because he believes in life and not death. Another aspect of human nature that we all have to be aware of, and because our people are great, is, I've mentioned this before, it's called projection. And what projection does, because you're a solid citizen, you want to do all the things that I mentioned in the previous part of the sermon, you want to obey God, you want to do this, that, because you're obedient to God, and in your mind, you cannot conceive of the evil that takes place, you tend to be dismissive of it or say, oh no, that can't happen. That can't be happening. That's got to be a rumor. That's got to be a conspiracy theory. That's projection. You know why? Because you would not do it. You have to get over that. No, still be a good person. But understand that Paul said for a good reason that evil men are going to get worse and worse to Timothy. Academically, we may be able to accept the precepts and the signs of Christ's coming, but are you willing to concede that the events that lead up to Christ's return are possibly the deliberate acts of these evil men? And maybe we see the results of those things happening from a prophetic standpoint, that they're not just accidental, but they're actually planned events that are deliberate, that people want to actually kill over. The final thing that I'll say that prevents us from understanding the world that we live in is what is called normalcy bias. Let's face it. We've been through some traumatic times in the last 4 years. We're back to normal now. You like it? You know, even though you're paying $4 a gallon more for gas in some places. It's back to normal. You know, you don't have to wear masks in Costco or stand in line or do some of these idiotic things. It's back to normal. We want that. It can be our friend or our foe. Our world has been turned upside down and has gone back to normal. We love that. But we're coming to a place, the most prominent place in the Bible that speaks of the time in which it won't go back to normal is Revelation 13, with the rise of the beast power and the mark of the beast. I won't go through the entire chapter, but the Bible prophecy reveals a darker age that is going to emerge in. And it ain't going back to normal after that. We may be well on the way, who knows? But Revelation 13 and verse 16 says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, that means virtually everybody on the face of the earth, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads. It's symbolic, obviously, you know that. It has to do with the ability to buy or sell, and it has to do with what the government is actually going to tell people to do, when they're going to worship, when they're, you know, what they're going to do in their personal lives. The mark of the beast is Sunday worship, required, enforced Sunday worship, easier to prove at a later time. The mark of this beast is going to be enforced worship of the beast, and it's going to affect the rest of the world. Now, we're not there yet. We've got time. We've got time to absorb some of these things and live our lives and pray for the best. The early part of the chapter says it's going to affect everybody in the world. It's not affecting us now. But this is something the world has never faced before in terms of the overwhelming dominance. In verse 3 of Revelation 13, it says, and I saw one of the heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. It skips generations and generations and generations after the fall of the Holy Roman Empire in 554, and then all of a sudden it resurrected again, and the world marvels at it and follows it. So they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who's like it? I mean, this is incredible. It's got to be of God. And they'll be deceived. And later on, Christ will return. And we'll all be a part of that. But, brethren, so how does a Christian order their lives? You've got to live your life to the full. You've got to be obedient to God. You've got to understand the nuances of what the Bible actually teaches and what it does not teach. You're not held to a standard just because some human ruler tells you you have to do it. And, you know, if you must comply, if it's not breaking God's law, then you can figure out a way to do that. Maybe you can find a way around it. God will provide a way sometimes. But a Christian's response to the world that we live in and its governments is pretty clear. We use the law of God, and we use the entire Bible to help us navigate through the end of this age.